I'm Hadley Beeman. I'm chairing the session. We're talking about using hardware, except that's a really unsexy name. I suspect we're going to be talking about doing phenomenal things with hardware. We're going to start with Graham Burnett talking about Unix FPGA, beyond just finance. Graham's got 15 minutes, which are going to be counted down by our trusty timer here. And his format is his. I don't know whether he's going to be doing questions or not questions or whatever it is he wants to do. And then we have a half an hour for Rob Bishop to talk about Raspberry Pis. So let's start with Graham. We'll start when you begin speaking.
Good afternoon. This is going to deliberately be a very terse presentation for sort of 15 minutes. I'm going to take you through what high-frequency traders have been doing in software. What high-frequency traders have been doing in software over the last 4 or 5 years. What's basically coming down the line as regards hardware and software, sort of like hybrid systems, and what the sort of tolerances are as regards the new 40 gig, 100 gig data feeds that are coming out there. So, quick quad chart, basically looking at what's actually happening here now. So we're talking 100 gig Ethernet data feeds hitting us probably, I would say, within 2 years' time. At the moment, we've already got 40 gig. That's been delivered using FPGA at the moment. We'll be discussing quickly some ideas of basically what GPU has been used for at the moment, what FPGA is being developed for, all the failures that we've had in the FPGA sort of sphere, and what the opportunities are going forward. So I've got some interesting ideas. I'll go through them so you can maybe I'll explain the acronyms. A lot of people are basically looking at hardware rather than software mechanisms to distribute market data to many, many servers. And the latest sort of thoughts in that technology is using ePCIe, which is essentially PCIe over copper cables. We're also looking at things called non-transparent bridging, which means that basically it's a routable bridge. You can actually sort of like use this as an 80 gigasecond transfer mechanism to talk to many, many servers. By the way, if you want to interrupt and ask questions, please do. I'd like to keep it interactive. I'm working for a small company called Hatstand. We're basically going to be doing COTS development for FPGA and GPU, etc. We've got some software that's already out there that we use to basically do a thing called counterparty value at risk, which is essentially Monte Carlo for counterparty risk, obviously. So, okay, here's the techniques that basically they're not teaching you at university at the moment. They probably teach you Java and C++ and all that sort of languages. But this is actually de facto what people are using. There's a great deal of work that was done by Keir Fraser et al. On lock-free technologies, which basically means that you don't have to use the operating system to intervene, and basically you can coordinate the activity of multiple threads quite easily and straightforwardly. Disruptor is an NMQ written by a guy called Martin Thompson. Martin has got great success and speaks very eloquently and very knowledgeably on Java that he's used. This asynchronous technique to communicate between threads. People are looking at things like work stealing queues, actors, state source, state syncs, which is what's actually used in the accelerate software, which I'll come on to shortly. Auto-vectorization is where you use the hardware to unroll loops and basically parallelize instruction sets. Vectorizer I.O. was a great hope of actually getting a whole NIC card's worth of data into main memory with one system call. It hasn't proved to be as useful as it could have been. SSE, which is basically using extensions to the processor to do essentially ASCII to binary conversions, etc. The work of Agner Fogg is really worth looking at if you want to learn exactly how microprocessors work, and looking at issues like fault sharing and TLB misses and all these other elements that are basically used in modern processor design to give the illusion that basic software executes simultaneously. The reality is, in electronic trading these days, we're looking at tolerances down to 10 microseconds, which is fairly sort of like low. And if you don't understand how the cache mechanisms work, then you're never going to be able to write software to that latency budget. There's also some GCC facilities that are very useful, like built and expect. So if you're writing an if-then-else statement, while there's no clue which branch is going to succeed, if you do, you can basically say most of the time this will actually be the branch that succeeds, and therefore L1 cache will be pre-primed with the actual with instructions. kernel bypass, where you basically don't actually bother doing any in-core copies, and it goes straight into user space memory. That's a very common technique to use this now. CPU pinning, where you hang a particular process and burn the CPU to bits to give you maximum liveness and therefore maximum performance. And people have basically been writing kernel modules for themselves and doing schedulers, etc. So that's basically half of what we've been doing. If you look at what we're doing on the network side, multicast is very popular, as always has been. But the things that basically people don't understand and miss are things like IGMP snooping. And what that basically does is it allows you to inspect the MAC of the packet and get the network and hardware to actually do the routing for you rather than doing a software router. That's quite fast. Used by a product called LBM from Now Informatica. Advanced techniques that came out of Google, receiver side scaling, whereby you attempt to use the majority of the hardware queues on the actual NIC cards so you can get faster I/O. This is great for Google, but it's not particularly useful for HFT. But it is quite useful if you're doing sort of job allocation, basically symbol threading across multiple processes where you're actually directing content to a particular process. There's a really good toolkit called DPDK, which is Intel's data plane development kit. It's got some fantastic, really good edifices in there for writing multi-core compatible software. Again, not that really relevant to HFT, but if you want to write fast, scalable, parallelized programs, the DPDK is a good way to go. There's another thing came out of Solarflare called EFVI that gives you 0.8 microsecond transit of a NIC, which is very, very fast indeed. Another academic project of note is a thing called NetMap, which came out of Livorno. It's a really good way of actually exposing the next buffer into core memory. So all these techniques are used for essentially making the transit from the market data into the main memory as quickly as possible. So why do we need to do this? Well, this is de facto, this exists today. So we've got basically, if you look at the figures, I'm not going to run through them, jumbo frames are just basically large 9K packets rather than the traditional 1300. We're dealing with, let's say, one message per microsecond. So if you've got a fixed message at that rate, you're not going to be able to parse it in software because the operating system itself has got a 3 microsecond jitter, so you're going to miss data. If you miss data and you're doing calculations like void-weighted average price and time-weighted average price, I'm really afraid you're not going to basically have accurate figures, therefore you can't trade. So there is basically a movement towards putting all this stuff in FPGA. Now, FPGA is not new technology at all. It's been around for a long, 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 long time. And if this is the important slide, this is the real sort of like, this is the real important slide. There's a lot of jargon in there, I do apologise. It's actually meant as a sort of seed slide deck for, basically many other sites to be written from. All these components are basically heading towards FPGA. So I'll take you through them very briefly because I think we've got time. So when you log on to an exchange at the weekend, usually Saturday night, midnight, you have to be at midnight exactly, as close as you can get to. If you're not, then basically you're at the back of the queue. And if you lose a session during the week, you won't get any fills, you won't be able to trade. So it's very important to do this. And to do this in software is all well and good, but actually it's really easy to do this in hardware. If you lose your connection, you need to basically cancel all your orders. So FPGA is actually quite good at issuing group cancels, as you can do in software, but it's much quicker, much more deterministic. BGP IGMP is used to control multicast traffic. That's normally done at the data plane layer by a Cisco router, and if you're talking to the very fast exchanges now, the kit's about 100k. There's a really good thing came out of academia called ZORP, which was written by a friend of mine, and we took that and used that instead. So there's a software hardware router. The next stage is to put this to the other side of the PCIe bus, i.e. on a NIC with an FPGA, and use it to basically do the session control, completely oblivious to the actual server itself. One of the things we've actually implemented over the last year and a half is an A-B line arbitration. When you talk to an exchange, you actually get two lines, an A and a B, and normally you have HSRP, which is a protocol to give you a virtual IP address, which takes 1.5 milliseconds overhead, by the way, so that's got to go. So you've got two lines coming from the exchange, and sometimes A is faster than B, and sometimes B is faster than A. So what you do is you hash each packet and say, I've seen that one, and you don't pass it up the line. Unfortunately, that's quite onerous in software, but this is ideal for FPGA. It's a small, discrete piece of functionality that you can actually put there, and it works really well. And that's been done. That's actually available commercially now. You might have heard people talking about microwave trading, people using microwaves to actually place trades across microwave links. What we're looking at now is putting it across the fibre, across the microwave simultaneously, and then whichever one gets it first is the trade, the other one gets dropped. And there's actually now microwave links all over between Basildon and the exchanges in London. That's actually happening now. Key thing that I think is really useful for FPGA is basic protocol conversions. 50% of any trade engine spends its time changing ASCII into integer, which is a real waste of time. So we can do that in FPGA. It's an ideal discrete functionality that can be there. We can also convert it into other formats. For example, protocol buffers. Thrift is the promising one. That's the one that's used by the guys who left Google, who wrote protocol buffers, and are now at Facebook. Thrift is used internally in Facebook. So you can actually build quite good market data infrastructure using Thrift, and it's very efficient. If you're dealing with 200,000 sort of like stocks, and basically 200 of those are really, really busy, putting it all in one processor is obviously not going to work. So you have to shred it across a series of processors. But that shredding has to be done in temporal order. In other words, you have to basically ensure that trades come from clients aren't, how can we say, put in front of other ones. So there has to be a temporal order maintained. So simple shredding using a sort of like work Sudoku won't work because you can't alter that temporal order. So FPGA is actually very, very good for doing the shredding activity in a timely, accurate manner. You can do also things like, and here's a really interesting one actually. A friend of mine, I thought he was going to be in the audience, but he's not unfortunately, was playing with Lua JIT from Mike Paul. If you've heard of that, it's an extremely fast language because it's purely register based, it's not an L1 cache. It's got a really, really intelligent JIT compiler, and the speeds that we were getting using that and hardware was just phenomenal. We were running business rules in between 60 and 90 nanoseconds. So we could actually do all the pre-risk checks that we need to do from our clients, basically using Lua JIT. We're looking at basically moving that further down into the actual FPGA, because FPGAs are now coming with ARM processors, which is very interesting for your next talk, actually. I think that's it. Right, so we've got 3 minutes left. Questions? Did anyone understand that?
Yes. So if you're doing packet hashing on your AB line arbitration...
Sorry, can I give you the microphone?
Sorry.
Oh, there you go.
When you're doing packet hashing on your AB line arbitration, surely this involves some kind of latency penalty, because you've got to store and forward the packet at the end of the line, right?
Yes.
Surely that's more than a microsecond.
No.
The transit time of an FPGA is roughly 300 nanoseconds, and to do the hashing probably adds about another 20-30.
But you've got to wait for the whole packet.
You do have to wait for the whole packet, yeah. Do you know how to do it without waiting for the whole packet?
No.
Fair enough. Any more questions? Yes?
What kind of budget do you have on logic elements? Are you using large FPGAs or...?
We're using the Stratix 5, which is, I think it's 4 million logic units. So, but this is the key thing here, is forget trying to write an electronic strategy on FPGA, you will fail.
Yeah.
Anything that does C to gates, there's a 10, 12-year history of failure. Handle C, System C, Impulse C is actually being used, but it's quite difficult to use. If you look at anyone who's tried to manually hack a VHDL, you can do one sort of hit, then you have to iterate every week. You can't do it in VHDL.
Yeah, well, I've worked how to do it without waiting for the whole packet. Yeah, I've worked how to do it without waiting for the whole packet.
Do you want a job?
Well, that was basically about my question. So what tooling are you using to write the FPGA bits? What's coming for that?
That's a very good question. We don't use the toolkits that come from the FPGA manufacturers. There's a toolkit that we're using, one's developed in-house by Solarflare called the FDK, which any university student can actually get in touch with either me or them, and they'll get a free board and basically a free license, so they can actually teach themselves that. So other things that we use, as I say, we're using Impulse C, and that's moderately successful, but it's a heavily pragma-laden language. It's difficult to learn. So what the most sort of like promise we think is going to be in System Verilog, which is a step up from VHDL. But the key to these is they're all very discrete components. There are no limited functionality and they're known functionality. They're not going to change every week. So that's the key. So when we can choose System Verilog to do the main implementation using the FDK.
I think we've got time for another question. There's a couple at the back here.
So
So this is all very cool, and you've got some nice tech here, but do you not worry that what you're doing is fundamentally daft, trying to trade faster and faster and faster?
Personally, yeah, it's daft. It's not the way I would trade. But the thing is, the people who are making $1 billion a year basically by having faster kit. So that's what the motivation is.
So it's a good excuse to get some academic research done.
Absolutely, yes. We do work with academia. We've got close contacts with Glasgow University and Cambridge, obviously, as well.
Track one more in
14
seconds.
Quick
question.
Yeah. So if you're the arms race question,
yes.
Are you looking at ASICs next?
No, not yet. But yeah, you're right, that's 20 times quicker than FPGA.
Yeah.
But we haven't got the FPGA bit right yet. So we need to do that one first before we ASIC it. Yeah, that's a good question.
What's the barrier to transitioning to ASICs?
Money.
Okay.
Money.
That's it. Thank you very much, Tommy, and thank you, Graham. Now we have Rob Bishop come up to talk about Raspberry Pi, and you have a double session, so let's give you 30 minutes on the clock. Also, I forgot to mention our hashtag. We are in hashtag, overall hashtag is OpenTag. Our hashtag for the session is #B3.
Okay, hi everyone. Those who haven't met me either in person or virtually, I'm Rob Bishop. I'm one of the two software engineers working for Raspberry Pi at the moment. Three overall engineers. We're a very small company, considering we've so far shipped 1.3 million units worldwide of the Raspberry Pi, which is pretty cool. I, as well as being an engineer, I also come and do the sort of evangelist bits, where I wander around either talking about the foundation itself, about our charitable aims, but also talking a bit about the tech. Now, I'm going to just expect that most of you have probably heard of the Raspberry Pi. Who here hasn't heard of the Raspberry Pi? Okay, in which case, I'll very gladly skip over the initial bit of talking about the Pi, and actually, I'll open up to some questions. There's a lot of people in here. I suspect a lot of people have Pis. Who has a Pi in here? Yeah, that's pretty cool. The second question, which normally gets a less positive response, is who's actually done something interesting with it? Yeah, you see, that's the problem, right? So my job has shifted from going around saying, hey guys, you can buy a computer with change for £20 notes, to actually wandering around and saying, hey, we're not in the business of producing cardboard boxes to clutter your homes, right? We're in the business of producing electronics that you can do cool things with. And so what I really want to do is take this time to share some projects, to talk about projects we've been working on, to answer some questions, with the aim of everyone leaving who has a Pi thinking of something cool they want to go and do with it. Because, you know, Sunday tomorrow, you're not at work, ample opportunity to get inspired today, chat it over and design it over a few beers this evening, and get to it tomorrow. And that's my mission for this weekend, right? Is to get the people here to actually do some cool things with it. So with that in mind, the people who said they had done something cool with it, if we can borrow the other microphone, does anyone want to talk briefly about something cool they've done?
I'm a member of the Manchester Hackspace, and we've got two of them which are controlling the RFID access control for our doors so that people can get in 24/7.
That's
at the moment, it's using a microcontroller as well as the Pi, but we're looking at seeing if we can run it more on the Pi's hardware itself.
Awesome. So is the code on... Is it open source?
Yeah, it's on GitHub, hackmanchester/alf.
Cool. And the RFID tech, is that something you've bought off the shelf? Or?
Yeah, the RFID readers are Wigan protocol readers, which we got from China for nothing. Then it's a Minimus at the moment doing the actual interface to that. But I say I'm looking at changing the way we're doing that a little bit. But yeah.
It's pretty cool. Any other projects people want to volunteer to talk about?
Hi, I'm Nick. I help out with Oxford Geek Nights. What we use our Pi for is internet to the pub where we have our talks. So we have a 3G dongle plugged in, we've got Wi-Fi, we've got a high-gain antenna, and then we gaffer tape it to the wall really, really, really high up so it gets above those awkward 2.4 gigahertz absorbing blobs of water that we all bring with us. The only issue we found is that 3G dongles draw lots of power when they're in use, but not when idle. So you set it up and you go, yay, it works! And then everyone starts using it and it falls off. So the trick is to get a powered USB hub and then it all seems fine. Until the pub object to you gaffer taping stuff off at the wall.
There's a good anecdote about power drawn by radios. In fact, we had some people on our forums who were reasonably competent, but still quite beginners, which is obviously what we're targeted at. And they both had exactly the same Raspberry Pi model, same revision. They had the same power supply. They were using one from an iPad from the same generation, and the same Wi-Fi dongle with exactly the same software. And one of them worked, and the other one didn't. And basically, what happens is you've got this magic effect where if you move your Pi sort of 10 centimetres closer to the base station, then your Pi works. Move it 10 centimetres further away, and magically it doesn't. Trying to explain why that was happening was quite fun. It's like, yeah, there's a magic ley line going down here. And, so, yes. One of the problems with radios, of course, is that the amount of power they draw does vary depending on the signal strength. So yes, powered USB hubs definitely help. We've released the camera this week, which is pretty cool. I've been talking about that since last September, so it's nice that actually people now have them.
And it's
sold out
already, unfortunately, for me.
Yes, so we produced 10,000, and I was saying to some people here earlier that we actually had a number of units, the first production units off the assembly in the Sony plant in Wales. And we were testing with those. We actually accidentally sent all of those out to other people to help test and people who had cool projects. And we then discovered that we didn't have any. And we went, oh, it's okay, we'll phone up Sony and buy some off them. And then we discovered they'd already sold out. So we almost ended up with no cameras in the actual Pi offices, which was quite funny. But we managed to claw back some from RS. So that was quite good. But yes, one of the problems with the camera is people have been saying, oh, there's some issues with image quality, and again, it's been a power supply problem. We were looking at a bunch of power supplies in the labs yesterday, and you know, you get these 5-volt supplies that you only minimally load, you know, a couple of 100 milliamps, and they're already dropping down to like 4.5 volts. You just get some very poor supplies. It's really interesting. We found that the Apple ones tend to actually be the best engineered ones. So if in doubt, those ones seem to work quite well, although they are pretty expensive. But yes, there's some really interesting... If you go and search, I think I tweeted about it recently, there's some really interesting pages where people have bought, you know, supposedly 5-volt, 1-amp supplies from a bunch of manufacturers and for a different... But, you know, from HTC and Samsung people, and profiled them. And it's really quite interesting to see how they behave or misbehave under load. You know, the two problems that should really hurt us is to do with ubiquity, you know. We said, oh, well, we'll ship it so it works with a micro USB phone charger. So anyone who has a phone charger, then that'll work, right? Good idea. In practice, not so much. Because the problem is that, again, you know, with it being a standard, you know, the layperson expects, well, it's USB, it'll work. Or this is a micro USB phone charger, it'll work. And, of course, you get a huge variety of standards within that. You have the same thing with USB. You know, people go, well, I have a USB aquarium, and so that should totally work with the Pi if I just plug that in, because this is USB, and that's a USB port, and it should work. I had the opportunity to go over to the Cupertino Apple campus in September last year, and I was talking to one of the guys who was in charge of bringing USB to the Mac, and they said they absolutely hated it, because, of course, Apple came into the game a bit later with USB, and there's all these devices that people just expected to work. You know, so a Mac does. So my USB device, which is nowhere even closely within specifications, it should just work with my Mac, right? So they have to make sure that their driver is, you know, and all their hardware works a huge range of possibilities. And that's it's a similar thing that's hurting us now. We've gone through lots of improvements in the USB driver. Just last week, we pushed out a patch that helps the FIC. When we were doing isochronous transfers, which should fix a lot of the USB issues. Certainly, there's a lot of people trying to use sort of USB DACs for audio, and they were having a lot of drop packets, the sound quality was poor. This fix seems to be fixing that quite well, and we've had some positive feedback. So if there's anyone in here who's been having USB issues, if you go into the forums, I believe on GitHub there's a branch which has the FIC patch on, and you can enable with the command line flag. And hopefully that should be fixing almost all of our USB problems. For those of you who don't know about the reason why I have the USB problems, basically the Raspberry Pi is based around an applications processor from Broadcom. It's a chip which is available in lots of phones, and that USB stacks, the Synopsys USB stacks available in even more phones than just the Broadcom chip, Unfortunately, in all of those phones, it's being used as a slave, because that's traditionally what these USB devices perform as in mobile phones. And you know, we spoke to Synopsys, and I said, "Oh yeah, the USB stack, it'll definitely do host, but yeah, let us know how you get on." And we basically bug tested their host drivers to 1.3 million people, so that was kind of fun. But yes. It's one of those things when you think you're going to ship 10,000 units and you ship 1.3 million, suddenly things you thought were going to be edge cases, those edge cases end up containing an awful lot of people, and that's a bit unfortunate. Are there any other cool projects people want to talk about? Alternatively, which is even better, are there any projects people have wanted to do but don't know how to, and we can summon the collective knowledge here to maybe give you a bit of a head start? I see some hands raising, that's really good.
Can I start with Chair's prerogative here?
Yeah.
I'm thrilled to have you here. This is something I've been meaning to ask for quite a while.
Yes.
I have a 9-year-old goddaughter who
yes.
I am helping to raise to be a proper geek.
Awesome.
And she, I have a Raspberry Pi for her. I've got her started on Scratch. But her general attitude is, why do I need to program this thing? I have an iPad that just works.
Yes.
What do we say to her?
So the iPad thing's really interesting. So again, when I was over at Apple, I was talking to the guys about the iPad. And if you think about it, what Apple are trying to do is they're trying to make computing invisible. They're trying to get to this magic box point. Apple aren't in the business of selling you computers, they're in the business of selling you Windows to content. Now, that's effectively what they're trying to do. They want incredibly intuitive systems that give you access to content at the fastest possible way. Now, for a lot of education, that makes a lot of sense, right? Having a means to deliver digital content very efficiently, very accessibly, is a great thing. The problem is that if we deliberately hide computers, and how are we going to get the next generation of kids to know that that's interesting and exciting? You know, if we've deliberately obscured all of their devices away from them, and, you know, we've removed all the mystery and the interest, and we've just made them invisible, then how are they even going to know that there's something there that they can, you know, play with, that does exist? You know, when you think about it, a lot of computers that buy today, you know, the Ultrabooks and the MacBooks and things, you know, you can't even actually take the cases apart, you know, all these sort of unibodies. We're going to have a generation of kids who don't know what a PCB looks like. You know, they've never seen a motherboard. We still have a generation who know, you know, what a microchip is, right? But the problem is we're getting to the point where that's so abstracted that we will have a generation of kids who've never seen a microchip, they've never seen a PCB. They don't actually know really what a computer is. And a very scary test for this is if you get kids under 10 to draw you what they think a computer looks like, they'll probably draw you a black slate with rounded corners. And that's kind of a bit terrifying, because actually they probably have, you know, if you take a computer to be a processor of some form, they probably have sort of 5 or so of them on their person at any one time. I know I probably have about 3 or so in my cell phone in my pocket. And so what we want to do is bring that back. It's really interesting equally that, talking about the FPGAs, you know, we've lost the skills where the average layperson knows what most of those terms mean. You know, we have. maybe not that far, but we've lost the skills where people who would describe themselves as computer engineers know what those terms are. You know, we've gone to a point where Cambridge University, sort of 20 years ago, you were expected to know 2 or 3 assembler languages if you were doing computer science. And these days, you know, they're lucky if they get people who know a bit of Java and a bit of HTML, right? And the problem is, if we lose those basic skills, you know, if we have fewer people actually producing the computers, you know, that's bad for the economy, it's bad for the industry, and it's bad for us as geeks, because we're going to have less cool toys to play. You know, we need people with the skills to make the devices for the content, not just people making the content. And I guess that's the answer, the long-winded answer to that question, which is, yes, they can just access content on their iPads. Yes, you can just consume. But we want to make sure that we actually expose the excitement of creating, we expose what's actually in the cases, and we expose basic electronics and computing, so that kids at least have an informed choice about whether or not that interests them. You know, how are they ever going to find that magical or exciting as I do if they're never even aware it's there? And that's part of what we're trying to do with the Pi. You know, you buy a Raspberry Pi, has no case. You know, it is low-level software. If you want to go write an OS in ARMv6 assembler, there's a course available for free from Cambridge you can download. You can go and do that. And equally, you know, the other cool thing is we want kids to experiment. The problem with asking to experiment on their parents' laptop or their MacBook or something is that, you know, computers have now become a vital part of our daily business. You know, your parents need their laptop to check their bank accounts, right? You need it for basic stuff. You saw how much of the government stuff's migrated to digital. You need that to be working. And so you know, there's a barrier to going and playing with it, to experimenting, to putting Linux on it, because you need that to be in a stable state. So our solution is, okay, you know, leave your Mac or your laptop, whatever, alone, if that's something you depend on, but here's a device you can buy and change for a £20 note that you're not depending on for anything. You know, this is a device that exists purely to play with, to hack, to experiment, to try Plan 9, you know, which you probably would never do any other situation, right, and to go and play. And I think it's that element of play that we're missing. Yes. There's a million questions and responses to that last monologue, so I'll let people answer.
Who should I be giving the microphone to?
The chap at the back seems like he might have a heart attack if you don't.
It's a false dichotomy. They don't, it's not an either or proposition. The nice thing about Raspberry Pis is you can buy 10 of them and still use your iPad.
Yeah.
Right now, the Raspberry Pi that I own is being an Xbox Media Center for my television, and I can control it from my Nexus 7. So if you want your kid to play with them, don't say, you have to put down your favorite toy to use the other toy. What you say is you go, this toy can expand your favorite toy, and now your favorite toy can control everything.
Exactly. I mean, they're not the same device. You know, your iPads, your tablets, they're about content delivery. You know, your Raspberry Pi is about creating stuff. You know, it's if the Raspberry Pi is about the journey, it's about how did you get to accessing the content, rather than what content were you accessing. And I think they work well together. I mean, you see people programming their Raspberry Pi and using their iPad to look up the, you know, terminal commands that they need. It's, they're different purposes. But I think they're both vital. And I think before the Pi, there was too much of a tendency towards, you know, just the content. And I think that was going to be dangerous. There were a few more responses.
There's an intro, there's a sentence in the introduction to this, one of the scratch books. To the kids, and it just says, are you fed up with doing what your computer tells you to do? Now you can tell the computer what you want it to do. And that sparked my friendship with playing the scratch. Because I think everything you've said I totally agree with, but it's our reasons for getting the kids involved. They need their own books to inspire them.
But it's another interesting question about accessibility, because I think accessibility and usability are different things, but tend to be put under the same bracket. You know, you look at the way operating systems are going, sort of Windows 8 and OS X and you know, iPhones and things, and actually they're very usable. They're very very low barrier, effort barrier, or knowledge barrier to go and use them. But actually, they're not very accessible.
No.
If you want to get to the guts of that, you want to make it do other things, you want to change it, you can't. You know, Linux, yes, its usability might be a little bit lower. It's maybe not as intuitive, but it is very accessible. You can make it do whatever you want to do. And, you know, we're always getting to the point where people, you know, kids don't even realise that they can change technology, they can adapt it and make it into other things, because they're so used to consuming and, you know, being prompted. You know, you look at Microsoft or SX or whatever, it's telling you what to do. Do you want to do this? You know, you are responding to choices that the computer's effectively making. The thing we always say about the command line when we teach kids is, the computer won't do anything unless you tell it to. And only then will it do exactly what you told it to. It won't say, I mean, unless you have a fancy shell, it's not going to say, did you mean to do this? You know, actually, I don't think that's a good idea. I think you should do this. It's going to do what you tell it. If you do RMRF star, right, that's going to end badly. But you can do that. And I think it's a very different way of interacting with computers to what kids are growing up with today. Some more questions.
Mine was more a bit of a thing about the what difference between our reasons for using stuff and kids' reasons for using stuff. I remember the thing that got me into programming in the first place was the BBC Micro, but specifically in the user's guide, it goes you through plugging it into your TV, you know, plugging in the power. The next thing it has you do is drawing funny colours on the screen.
Yeah.
And you get this real interest before your attention span has run out. It doesn't tell you how to load stuff off tape. It doesn't tell you how to load your computer game. It has you drawing pictures.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is really key. It's getting something interesting really, really early, because kids' attention spans are really short.
Yes. And I think there's another interesting fact there, which is, you don't excite kids today by drawing a turtle in a box around the screen, right? That's not exciting. But making an actual robotic turtle, which moves in a box shape, that's a little bit more interesting. And so one of the great things about the Raspberry Pi is, one of the questions we get a lot is, how come you spend so much time around hackers and hackathons and stuff when you're an educational charity? And the answer is that you guys make the cool things that make the kids want to program. Right? It's you guys who actually have, guys and girls, who actually have the knowledge and ability to go and make the interesting projects, the things which move, which look shiny, which actually we can go take to kids, we can show them, they get inspired, and they go, how did you do that? And we can actually show them how to do it. You know, one of the great things about open source, if you see a cool project, you can download it, you can tweak some minor bits of the source code, you can make it your own. Another one of the basic lessons we often do is we give the kids snake in Python. And we say, okay, change the colour of the snake. You know, and they don't know anything about Python, but they can read through the source code, they can see where it says blue, and they can change that to red. And suddenly they've changed the game in a very visible way. And it's this way that, it's very accessible to go and do cool stuff, and it's very easy with the web to go and see cool stuff other people have done. And so, one of my reasons for being here is to encourage people who are working on cool projects to get them visible, let's blog them out, put them online, and equally for people who have cool projects are thinking of, do it for yourself, but also do it so we can inspire the next generation, because we are dependent on it. And at one point, we're going to get to the point where, the older generation of kids have the skills to inspire the younger generation. It'd be great to see sort of in-school hackathons and code clubs and things where the older kids are making the cool projects, which the younger kids get involved in. But the older kids don't have the skills at the moment. So it's up to us to start that cycle off and hopefully watch it grow from there. Okay, there's some more questions.
I'm concerned that the Raspberry Pi is being put down to a cost. A lot of people get the Raspberry Pis, or the experience is they get the Raspberry Pis, they plug it into the television and it doesn't work. And it doesn't work because the power supply isn't good enough.
Yeah.
And this is extremely frustrating for somebody who sees something, is exceedingly excited about it, and then when it gets it, for no fault of their own, it simply doesn't work.
Yeah.
I think the Raspberry Pi project should actually be engineering the project up so children don't have these problems.
So I agree with this. So one of the things that I've personally been pushing quite hard on is we want to keep the accessibility that I was talking about earlier. We don't want to dumb down the command line. We need to have access to Linux. But how can we accelerate people going into that so that it's, the effort barriers at the point where we want them to learn something? What we want to do is get them to a state where they're on command line Linux, where they're playing with Scratch as easily as possible, and then give them the maximum amount of opportunities from then onwards. There is an announcement, it's Maker Faire in San Francisco today, thinking time zones, this evening for us. There will be an announcement on some stuff I've been working on there, which is going to help significantly with that. Can't talk about it yet, but it's really cool. We are aware that the out-of-box is not as easy as it could be, and we're working on it. It's one of those things where we scaled a lot faster than we expected to, right? So we sold a lot more units before we were really ready. And it's only now that we're sort of backfilling with educational partnerships, with examples like OCR, doing educational material, and really just refining the software. Bear in mind this was all done by people in their evenings and weekends, and we still only have a team of four engineers working full-time on this. Which, trying to produce a new product and support 1.3 million users is tricky. Yes, some more questions.
I never bought one because of no VGA.
Sorry.
I didn't have a television to plug in.
Yeah, so VGA is a tough one, right? The problem is that the Raspberry, a lot of people say, why have you got a Broadcom processor? Why have the design choices been as they are? The thing to remember is that we didn't sort of... put out an application for chip vendors for a socket for a thing called a Raspberry Pi. we spun out from Broadcom. I used to work at Broadcom with Evan Upton, obviously founded Raspberry Pi, and we worked on this applications processor, which is in a number of smartphones. And it was only really on seeing that we had this very cheap but very powerful processor that we realized we could take the development kit for that and cut it down to something which is the Raspberry Pi. You know, the Raspberry Pi is almost a hack of something else rather than being designed specifically for purpose. One of the side effects of that is that modern APs don't support VGA. You know, some support HDMI. We're lucky that we actually also happen to have analog video on this chip as well. Most modern APs don't have that. You know, it's the same reason why there's no analog audio. There's no analog audio because we want it to be as cheap as possible. There's no analog audio on the chip. Audio silicon is expensive. So with a bit of hacking with a PWM and an RC network, we have our audio subsystem is amazing. If you go down the schematics, we have a PWM pin and an RC network, and that is how we produce your 8 kilohertz bandwidth analog audio. Right? It is the best hack ever. And it's quite, well, it's quite clever, actually. I'm quite pleased with it. But otherwise we don't have any analog. And yeah, VGA would help, but it's more silicon. You know, we'd have to pay a couple of bucks to buy the silicon, with probably another $2 or $3 probably to buy the connector. And, you know, it wasn't something that we could do at the price point in the first place. Now, one of the great things is, because we support analog TV out, actually what we advise the schools is go on FreeCycle, go on Craigslist, and get hold of some cheap or free CRT monitors. You know, you have to pay to dispose of your CRT monitor at the moment, so you can probably get hold of 2 or 3 CRT monitors for free, just by looking around, and the Pi will work well with it. So that's our sort of low-cost solution to that. You know, again, it's one of those design choices. If we were designing from scratch, we probably would have VGA, but you know, it was a choice of sort of this or no Raspberry Pi, and that's where we were.
Got a few more questions here. Sorry,
Start here. The Raspberry Pi, I've noticed, has a connector for some kind of display screen. Is there anything that plugs into that? And if not, is there likely to be?
So we've always said, much like we're going to do the camera, we're going to do the display connector. As Evan said the other week, we've now spent $100,000 on those display connectors. So it'd be a bit of a shame if we never actually did anything with them. It's amazing how connectors, which are a couple of cents, when you ship 1.3 million units or something, ends up being a ridiculous investment in connectors that are currently unused. We are committed to doing that. Now the camera's out the door. That's our next project. It runs over DSi. It's like the camera in the fact that although it's a standard, obviously your drivers need to be tuned for it, and the drivers are in the GPU. So it is dependent on us producing that, but it is something that we're going to do.
Those of us who don't know, what is that?
CSI and DSI are high-speed serial interconnects used for camera and display. CMD. And those are the black FPC connectors that are on the Raspberry Pi. So one of them's for the camera, and one of them will be for the display when we produce it.
Here at the front again.
Hi. The simple question is, how do you get to education? Kind of the more long drawn out version of it is, I was at BET, the British Educational Technology Trade Show, where there was quite a lot of talk about Raspberry Pi and how it was going to do great things for education. Quite a lot of teachers were quite enthusiastic about it until they realised that they'd have to teach it. And they got no idea. And you know, I've spoken to very intelligent people, some of which have engineering or computing degrees, and they're probably not that able to teach that kind of curriculum in school. So
yeah.
how's it going to work?
It is a difficult problem. I mean, we're working at the moment with OCR. So OCR are the exam board, which is owned by Cambridge Assessment, which is obviously owned by the University of Cambridge. We're spun out from the University of Cambridge effectively. Most of our trustees work in the computer science laboratory. And so we have very good links with them. And what we don't want to do is write a syllabus which is dependent on the Pi. Right? We don't want to go down the path of Windows, where what we're effectively trying to do is write a syllabus which sells our product. Right? We're a charity, that's not what we're set out to do. What we want to make sure is that there is a good syllabus. And as a result of there being a good syllabus, that can be done on a device which is $25 rather than $250. That's effectively what we're trying to do. You know, the Pi wasn't designed for classrooms. There's this one of the big misconceptions is that what we're saying to schools is, oh, throw away all your existing, you know, computer suite of perfectly good machines and replace them with sort of low-powered ARM V6 machines. That doesn't make any sense, right? Our suggestion is, you know, we want kids to learn programming. We want them to learn Python, ideally, as a starting language. So go and learn Python on the machines you have. But like we said before, you know, moving a turtle around the screen is less exciting. But what you can do is you can take that Python and those skills you learned on your x86 machines, put them on the Pi, and suddenly, you know, you've created a weather monitoring station which you've left in the school fields overnight, and you've been collecting data over Wi-Fi. You know, suddenly you've built a Nerf gun turret which responds to people's faces as they walk in through the door. You know, you've built a robot, you've built a drone, you've built a, you know, some sort of synthesizer involving a makey-makey where you've got bananas as keys. Actually, at BET, it was Cheltenham Makespace, and they had one of the Parrot AR drones, which they controlled using the Raspberry Pi, a Wi-Fi dongle, a makey-makey, and some bananas. So you could use these bananas to control the drone. And that's cool. And it's not very hard to convince a kid that that's a cool thing to go and play with. But the point is that the skills involved in that, yes, you could do on the desktop, but it'd be much more difficult to move that desktop out of the classroom and go and put it in the field to go and do data logging for whatever science you're doing, or to turn it into a bleep test for PE, where you're, you know, creating a database of how fast people can sprint.
Where do the staff come from, though?
Like, sorry?
The staff in schools right now aren't set up for this, and
not yet.
Very difficult to find out where they're going to get the training from.
Yeah, there's lots of training that's required. The whole syllabus for IT, as I'm sure you guys are aware, is changing for computing. There's a whole new syllabus that's coming through. It's not really my area of expertise to talk about that, but you know, it is a computer science syllabus. It's a computing syllabus. The teaching will be necessary because you will need those skills in order to pass the GCC. The recommendations from the government suggest starting with algorithmic thinking in primary school. So, you know, now that those guidelines have been set, the schools are going to have to pick up those skills. And, you know, there's people like OCR and other bodies that are doing the CPD to backfill the skills to do that. The cool thing is just getting the change in place so that, you know, instead of saying schools, you really should spend extra time teaching computing, now it's you have to spend extra time teaching computing. Here's how we can help. Which I think is going to make a big change.
On that very specific note, the plan is that they are going to be, there's been a set of money aside, I think it's like £1.2 million to train people that are already, you know, IT teachers that are good and have got the skills, train them to then train others, and they'll go around all the schools in the country, and it's going to be basically a sort of top-down training type scheme to get all of these teachers able to teach the new curriculum. There was an announcement about it a few weeks ago. I can't remember the full details. Adam O'Donoghue would know more. I don't know if he's here today or not.
He's not. I don't think he's here today. But
they think about a year.
Yeah.
Absolute rubbish.
Well, probably, but
there are 3,600 schools in the UK who've got have teachers capable of teaching the subject. There are nowhere near that number, and the children who are not at school and have teachers who can teach the subject are at complete disadvantage. It's a scandal what's going on. It's not being properly addressed by the DfE.
Before we completely degenerate into a political debate, as useful as that might be, that sounds like a good thing to hold for the pub. We've got time for about one more question, and then we need to wrap up. Who do you want to go for?
Does anyone have a project, a hopeful project question, rather than a we're all doomed question? Yes.
Moving a dissimilar operating system to... Raspberry.
Sorry?
Moving Tails, for example, to a Raspberry.
A different OS.
Yeah.
So,
based on Debian.
Yeah, so moving an OS based on Debian should be reasonably feasible. Obviously, all of our kernel is available on GitHub. You know, it is a case of taking the kernel and adapting that and integrating it as necessary. We support a ridiculous number of operating systems now, everything from RISC-OS, which is obviously doesn't even run on the Linux kernel, to Plan 9.
RISC-OS,
yeah, got RISC-OS for Plan 9. So obviously all the different Linux distros from Gentoo to Puppy to Arch. There is a massive amount of support. And if there's something which we don't support, please come and help us. I was reading about Nixos, which I think would be kind of a cool thing to port that as well, actually. if anyone wants to challenge. And I still really want to see Minix as well at some point, although no one's done that.
BSDs.
Yes, BSD has been ported as well.
Did Pace release the latest RISC-OSS in the end?
Yes, for free for Pi users.
What happened to the Android port?
So the Android port's a bit of a... it's a political thing. Mm. There's two issues, one of which is, as most of us know, Android isn't really open source, right? So actually, Broadcom have a very well-working Android port for the AP, because of course they sell it in volume, but Broadcom own that, and actually that's not open source. So that's tricky. The other problem is actually Android's not very good for content creation. Mm. You know, the Pi is a content creation device, it's not a content consumption. And so there is a worry if you put Android on it, everyone would just go and run Android apps on it. But we kind of don't really want that. So, you know, we're focusing more on operating systems which are more about learning and creating. There are a lot of community ports working on Android.
And if you put Android, would Microsoft try and extract some patent money from you?
Yes. Well, yeah. The whole legality of various things is very tricky. I'm amazed no one's asked me about the GPU. We're doing our best.
Okay, I'm afraid we're going to have to wind things up. Please join me in thanking Rob. And many thanks to Graham as well, who I think has already left us, which is unfortunate, because I wanted to find out if he thought what you were doing was going to help build the workforce he needed for his projects. But we'll have to catch him another time.
Cool.
Thank you all. Next in the session, we have Thinking Differently. Stay with us.
Jet lag.